Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. This week, we turn to an unfamiliar field of endeavour for design, to sport. First, we donour sporting colours to mull over the role of stadiums in our cities.
Balancing those bits between civicness, in an architectural sense, producing a building that is civic in its nature, but also the user experience is slightly different because it's actually a fan.
Chris Lee there, the architect behind the redevelopment of North London Football Club Tottenham Hotspur's new stadium. But can the design of a sporting venue have off-the-field impact in our cities too? Next.
There have been various studies that have shown that equally good individuals that are wearing red are more likely to be marked higher by referees and are more likely to win.
Journalist Cassia St. Clair joins us to tell how a cunning kit choice and colour can make you a winner in the sporting arena. We also take a breather from all that sports talk with a tour of a modernist housing complex in Belo Horizonte, courtesy of the late Oscar Niemeyer. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now, as well as being a landmark which travelling sports teams visit and a badge of honour for cities that hold them, a stadium is, or should be, a social space at heart. However, there's a track record of these spaces struggling to find a role in civic life, particularly after the Olympic medals have been dished out and the rostrums dismounted after large events. Tottenham Hotspur is the latest football team to undertake an expansion of its stadium, a vast architectural project, the impact of which will likely be felt beyond match days, with the potential to transform the surrounding borough for the better. We sent a fairweather football fan and Monocle 24's executive producer, Tom Edwards, to knock about some ideas with the architects.
Now, sports stadium design is something of a thorny issue. Wherever we go in the world, there's certainly an array of white elephants, if projects even get that far. So how do you balance the need, sometimes conflicting, always controversial, between utility, commercial imperatives, frequently a municipal or public service responsibility, and the more subjective elements like, I don't know, the atmosphere in the ground for the crowd? All of these critical questions, of course, regard design. How can great design enable these projects to fly and avoid all those pitfalls? Well, today we're visiting the site, a true work in progress, of what will be London's largest club football stadium. We're off to Tottenham in North London to visit White Hart Lane, home of Tottenham Hotspur Football Club for more than a century. A quick clip along the high road from here at Seven Sisters, and we'll be there. OK, so we're standing in the corner of Park Lane and Tottenham High Road, and a critical question after a rather taxing journey to get here involves integration with the local infrastructure, if you can call it that. One maybe to put to the stadium designers and some key figures from the club who we're going to be talking to. Let's head inside. From the chilly street to the altogether better heated and far more salubrious expanse of the suites in Lilywhite House, the club's new HQ, and the place today where some of those key figures in what the club and borough hope will be a transformative development are sharing some views on the build, literally and metaphorically. I began by asking Donna Cullen, one of Spurs' directors, about the role that the club plays in the community. She'd earlier described both the new stadium and the club itself as a beacon for the community. She told me more about this.
Because we were sited in Tottenham, which is an area of such deprivation, we would take very seriously our responsibility and what football brings to the table to make sure we could do what we should do on the ground. And we set up the foundation, which is actually coming into its 10th year this year, on the back of what most football clubs will have as a playing for success. But we did it as a charitable foundation. We underwrote it to the tune of £4.5 million so that it could be serious, and it made sure that it was here from day one and wasn't going anywhere overnight. We have a staff of 128 plus volunteers in the foundation who run around 74 projects at any given time, and there'll be health, education, crime diversion type projects. But what we've absolutely focused on in this area is education and employment on the belief that if you sort those two aspects, all of the other ills that you might find in society tend to be less. We've always been embedded in this community over the past two decades. What this gives us now is the opportunity to actually do more of those projects right here on this site, the fantastic southern realm that's larger than Trafalgar Square. So we've programmed that and we've designed it with Chris at Populous's help as well to make sure that, yes, it goes from the east to the west across the site, but actually if we're crossing that, you'll actually be able to pick up on what else is happening there, and the foundation will manage projects on that site.
Christopher Lee is the Managing Director of Populous. An architect and designer by training, Chris has created more than 30 sports stadiums on five continents. His projects include the main stadium for the 2000 Sydney Olympics. I put it to him that he has to balance social, civil and municipal responsibilities alongside commercial and sporting ones, and that many of these could be at odds.
The challenge that I think the football clubs have, because they are community places that people love, they're grandfathers, fathers, they're something that the people own, but at the same time they're a business and they need to make money and provide longevity. So I think balancing those bits between civicness in many sense, in an architectural sense, producing a building that is civic in its nature, but also, as you say, the user experience is slightly different because it's actually a fan. It's a fan who's been coming to the lane their whole lives, their parents have been taking them. So it's a balance between getting public interaction, community buy-in, providing enough space and genuine permeability, I think, of the building and the site that the local area feel that it's their building.
So where does Chris's inspiration come from? Does it come from studying stadiums that work particularly well? Or rather, those that maybe didn't, and trying to avoid those same pitfalls?
We've spent a lot of time looking at stadiums around the world. We've spent a lot of time with the client going to visit new stadiums, new arenas as well, not just stadiums, but different kinds of buildings. Anything from the Cooper Union Architecture School in New York that Daniel and I went to visit, to airports that we liked, just to see things that we liked. And that's part of the design journey. And I think designing buildings like this, I mean, it really is a journey. There isn't a single big fat sketch where you say, right, that's what we're all doing and now just deliver it. You know, it's a process. And working with clients, with Donna and Daniel and the rest of the team to work through that process. I mean, obviously the site's an incredibly complex site. I think it's the only stadium in the UK literally on a high street. It's tight, it's compact. So all of those bits, it's sort of managing the complexities of the site, the client's aspirations, the community aspirations, and creating a vision that comes out of that has been, I mean, it's been great fun.
Confident swagger about Spurs here. What about that for a ball from Dyer? What about that for a finish from Harry Kane?
One of the great intangibles in all of this is atmosphere, but it's of such worth to the team and to the club. How do you go about quantifying and incorporating that into your plans? Donna Cullen explained how the club's gone about it.
We had a great starting point because White Hart Lane is one of the smallest stadiums in the UK, if not Europe, at 36,000, and the fans are right on top of the pitch. So our brief to Chris was, get us as close to what we've already got here as you can. The other thing that we were just focused on doing as well was a single tier stand, not to break it. You know, you look at Borussia Dortmund and Liverpool, this is bigger than both of those. It will be the most amazing sound coming off that south stand.
I might be in there, hopefully, if I get to move wherever I want from Park Lane end. And Chris, just tell me a bit more about that. Westfalenstadion, hugely famous, celebrated for this extraordinary COP. That was presumably front and centre, as Donna said then, from the beginning. Was it easy to incorporate that kind of feature?
No, it's not easy. But I think the bits we as designers and the club were really passionate about was there are wonderful things about old English stadiums and the lane particularly, the separate stands, the proximity, the incredible atmosphere. And I think atmosphere is a slightly intangible mix between a bit of science and quite a bit of art. Noise is one incredibly important thing. So the single tier stand was a really big move for us all. One, it breaks the seating bowl up. It has a front and a back, a left and a right, rather than a sort of more generic complete seating bowl. You have, therefore, identities. The single tier stand, because it's 17,000, it's single tier, it's steep. The work we've done with our acousticians, the singing lasts longer. You get the reverberation times, and songs break down because the reverberation times, they slow, everyone gets out of sync, and then they stop. So you start these songs that go longer and last longer, pick up the rest of the stadium. So this becomes our part of our engine for driving atmosphere. I think the other thing for atmosphere is actually just seeing people. So when you're in multiple stands, you don't ever feel you're in this enormous sort of sea of people. You can get that feeling in the south stand. It's huge, 17,000 people, really noisy. So the atmosphere, and noise makes noise, basically. The louder it gets, the louder everyone else gets. So you start creating this incredible atmosphere that runs through the stadium, which I think has been really important. I think it'll be a phenomenal atmosphere there.
From there, Chris Lee led us out of Lillywhite House, down the high road, and then into the corridors of the fine old stadium, alongside the famous turf, and then up again, and through, and out, onto a viewing platform behind the Paxton Road end, overlooking the construction site, where the new iteration of White Hart Lane is looming up. Blue and white cranes, emblazoned with the club's stylised Cockerill logo, dominate the landscape of the high road. Chris explained what we could see from our lofty vantage point, surrounded by the unmistakable sounds of a building site.
What we're looking at now, so you can see the lower tier becoming to wrap in. So that's a nicely steep lower tier, which is really important for us. So it's what in sports architecture term we call a C90, which is 30 degrees or 30 increments steeper than others in London. The rakers, which you can see, so the sort of serrated bits of concrete kicking out, that's the beginning of the mid-tier, so you can see that wrapping over two levels. We're at level 5 here in the northwest corner. We're going up to level 9 in the total building. So I think I worked out before, see the cab on the crane over there? That's about the height of the outside of the roof. So you'll see, so we're up about that level. So if you can imagine that wrapping around on three sides, gives you a bit of an idea of scale. If you can imagine a football pitch in here, on the two sides we're about 7 metres from the touchline, from that concrete wall on either side. On the north and the south we're about 5 metres, which is incredibly close. In fact, we'd got it to 4 metres, which was Daniel's requirement to get us close, and then we realised it's probably a little bit too close. And Hugo might be being able to be touched by the fans behind it.
Daniel is Daniel Levy, the Tottenham chairman. Chris explained that he continues to field plenty of almost daily calls and texts from Levy, whose attention to detail seemingly knows no bounds. Chris explained, though, that far from holding any fear, this is a vital part of a necessary process that surrounds all projects, or certainly all those that end up delivering the goods.
I think design's a real process. I think this idea that there's some architect with a fat pen who does a sketch and then they go off and build it. You know, I guess we've been working on this for 5 years now. Working with Daniel, I mean, Daniel texts me about 6 times a day saying, have you seen this or thought about that? So the process has been great. So we've had lots of freedom, lots of ideas. Daniel, if anything, pushes, continues to push. Is that good enough? Can we do better? Should we change this? Should we improve that? So it's been great. It's been great fun. Challenging, but great fun. I think Daniel wanted to create a stadium that's unlike any other, and that genuinely, I know that's a sort of catchphrase, but he really did want to create something that's totally unique, that had character and personality. And I think one of the things he was scared of was creating a generic stadium, creating a stadium that didn't have personality. I mean, White Hart Lane's such a lovely stadium. It's so quirky and it's nuanced. And he wanted to incorporate that in. He wanted the best bits of traditional English stadiums to be brought in. So that drove the thinking around the single tier, the steepness, the proximity, all of the great things about old stadiums that he didn't want to lose. That creates something that's quite unique.
As with many highly complex design challenges, the proof of the new facility's fitness for purpose can only really be supplied once it's open. Once the fans discover and engage with all the amenities. Once the transport infrastructure is put to the test. And as our hosts explained, the additional burden for the club in this neglected corner of North London can weigh heavier than that. They're the main employer, a social hub, a beacon for the community even. So will White Hart Lane 2.0 serve all of these interests? Well, after today, I just feel it might. For Monocle in Tottenham, I'm Tom Edwards.
Lifelong Tottenham Hotspur fan and Monocle's executive producer Tom Edwards there, meeting his heroes and reporting from White Hart Lane, at the home of Tottenham Hotspur Football Club in North London. Next up, we mull over the importance of colour when it comes to competitive sports. Now, Cassia St. Clair is a London-based design journalist who specialises in the history of colour. And she joined this show's producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan, in the studio to explain why kits matter and how the commercialisation of sport have made the hues all the brighter.
Most people, when thinking about colour in sport, will just recognise that the colours have become brighter and brighter and brighter, with the exception of a few sports like tennis that have sort of really stuck to their guns and been very muted. Most sports have really adopted very, very, very bright, vibrant colours, a really sort of bold palette, you know, even neon. And I think that's the most significant change.
And why has this taken place? What have the causes been?
There are several causes. I think one of the most important is that there's just been a huge rush for commercial sponsorship in sports. And there've been a huge increase in people watching sports and sort of consuming sports via images, whether it's Instagram or on television. So, for example, it was estimated that I think it was 3.6 billion people saw at least a minute of the 2012 Olympics. That's a huge audience. And obviously people are desperate to tap into that. So to catch people's eyes, you know, in these very busy sporting events, they've really sort of amped up their colours. If the camera's panning through a crowd or panning across a sports field, you want people to pick up your product or your sportsman instantly. And then also, as a reaction to this, there's been this sort of arms race. As a reaction to that, the sporting events themselves have really amped up their colours. So Rio was really very, very bright and you know, the colours echoed the flag, but also you know, there were all these sort of words like energy and eco-friendliness, and there was really lots of colour. And then, of course, London 2012 was famous for its bright, bright, bright fluorescent pink as well, that was used to distinguish the Olympic events from just sort of the regular run of London. And so they wanted, again, a really eye-catching colour that people, visitors from all over the world, would be able to really quickly recognise that hue as the Olympic hue and know where to go.
So aside from the marketing justifications for these changes in colour, you know, the manufacturers of different sportswear companies and different football teams want their products to catch the eye of spectators so they can and sell more of them. There are various functional justifications given for these changes in colour, the increased brightness. Obviously, as you can imagine, contrast is important on sports pitches for people to be able to see what's going on. And I wonder, do you know anything about the specific ways particular colours function on sports fields? I was doing some research before I spoke to you, and there were various kind of psychological papers looking into how the different coloured strips affect like referees' decision-making or strikers' performance in penalty shootouts. Do you know of anything along those lines?
One of the most famous ones has been the use of red by different sports teams. Looking at Olympic sports, there have been various studies that have shown that equally good teams or equally good individuals that are wearing red are more likely to be marked higher by referees and are more likely to win. I mean, it's sort of, I think, 55%, you know, 45%, something like that. But there is this slight uptick of wins when you're wearing red, and red is seen as a very confident, bright, aggressive colour. And so perhaps that's not surprising, particularly in combat sports. But I think also there's another interesting fact about televisions and the colours that can be seen very well on high definition and even ultra high definition televisions. So with a regular television, you can see around 250 colours. They distinguish between 250 different colours. But with an ultra-high definition television, you can see well over 1,000. So with these sporting events, with, again, highly saturated in colour, a team has got that can kind of really use these colours to their advantage will be more visible, which I think appeals to a lot of people.
And you write a lot about the semiotics of colour in various different fields. Now, with this move towards the more kind of bright neon end of the spectrum, I'm not even sure if neon is part of the spectrum, you'll be able to tell me. What do those kind of hues, those kinds of colours mean outside of sport? And how do you think their increased prevalence in sport interacts with the meaning of those colours outside of sport?
I think it's very interesting because neon colours, you know, were huge in the 80s and then everyone got very sick of them. I think it's true to say, although I don't have any sort of proof or figures to back this up, that when you have very bright colours or when you have very strong, striking combinations of bright colours, we tend to sort of get fatigued with them faster than we would if they're sort of two muted colours or two colours that sort of sit very calmly next to each other. And I think that this helps in sport where you want sort of a higher turnover and you want things to continually look fresh. But then there's also just the problem that it just gets so shouty that if you are the team that has a grey and a navy blue, it'll just sort of be a complete relief to all the viewers and possibly to the fans buying the strip as well.
That was Acacia Sinclair speaking with Section D's very own Henry Rhys Sheridan. Her book, The Secret Lives of Colour, is published by John Murray and available at all good bookshops now. Now, the late Oscar Niemeyer was perhaps Brazil's greatest architect, responsible for many of the country's most beloved structures, including the National Congress Building, amongst many, many others in the capital of Brasilia. For the February issue of Monocle magazine, we dispatched Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent Sheena Rossiter to one of Niemeyer's early works. The JK building in Belo Horizonte, the capital city of landlocked Minas Gerais state, was built in 1951. It's the tallest high-rise in the town and the most populous, housing thousands of people in its 1,087 units spread across two stately apartment blocks. Sheena visited the JK building to see what makes it so charming and find out some home truths about its current residents.
Cars huff and puff as they inch their way in Belo Horizonte's slow-moving one-way traffic around the not-so-identical JK building towers, one standing 22 stories high and the other topping out at 36 floors. Belo Horizonte's JK building sits at the heart of this city, nestled nicely in the center of the coastless state of Minas Gerais. And with over 1,000 apartment units spread across the two apartment blocks, the Oscar Niemeyer project, an idea originally conceived back in 1951, only to actually be completed in 1970, is still actually the most populous apartment towers in the city, being home to thousands of people. Many people don't actually know how many people live between these walls here, where everyone from families can be found to young working professionals. But that was the whole concept of the JK building, to marry the idea between the high-density building projects that were going up in cities like New York at the time, and to make it communal spaces with facilities like in densely populated European cities. At the time of its construction, the JK building, a large communal living building with floor-to-ceiling windows, was the first of its kind to be constructed in the tropics.
Repórter CBN, as principais notícias do dia a cada meia hora.
Bom, então esse apartamento especificamente, primeiro ele tem um tipo.
On the 20th floor of the apartment, I meet Pedro Moraes, who lives in the original three-bedroom apartment that Niemeyer designed for former governor Juscelino Kubitschek, whom the building was named after, and who then went on to become president of Brazil. Pedro is an expert on the building, having written his doctorate thesis on high-rises in Latin America. He literally has been living in his thesis for the past 12 years. He explains how the JK building was revolutionary when the idea was conceived in the early 50s.
These kind of buildings have just arrived in Latin America from a crossing of influences, from this social vision from the Europe 20s and 30s, but also from the North American idea of multiplication of urban soil, that is, from a commercial point of view, and that take these both influences to make housing vertical.
It took decades for the doors of the JK building to actually open themselves to residents, and by the time it finally opened, Brazil was a very different place from when the idea was conceived. Pedro Moraes, again.
And in the meanwhile, the situation in Brazil has changed a lot, because in the 50s we have this developmentalism vision of the city and of the country, but in the 70s we were already among this dictatorial military regime. So the gathering of 3,000 people together in a building was not something viewed with a nice view from the government and everything. So a lot of instruments of social control has been put in the building, substituting the cultural and social items that should happen mainly on the contact with the street and everything.
Indeed, the JK building hasn't exactly had the most squeaky clean reputation over the years, having been known to have been a hotbed for prostitution and squatters up until recently. But new life in the building is helping revive some of the units, thanks to the work of Marcelo Alvaranga's firm, Play Arquitectura, which has refurbished several of the apartments in the JK building.
First in Frozen Zeckmeister's office, and after in Isai Weinfeld's office.
Marcelo, who had a stint working under famed Brazilian architect Isai Weinfeld, shows his talents in modernist design. In total, Play Arquitectura has only refurbished 4 apartments in the building, but as he says, they play on making the most out of these small spaces.
Originalmente, 2 quartos.
He tells me that working in cabinetry into the large pillars, the characteristics in the center of these apartments are commonly worked into its designs as a way to open up these apartments with the use of natural light from the floor-to-ceiling windows. With influence from Japanese and Brazilian modernism designs, Play Arquitectura's apartments combine Japanese practicality with making the most out of small spaces by using convertible walls that can open up space or can be closed for privacy, with Brazilian woods and bright colors.
É para marcenaria, uma marcenaria fixa, armários, painéis.
A few floors down, I meet Paulo Rakic, a filmmaker who's lived in one of Play Arquitectura's refurbished apartments since April. Aside from the attraction of living in a newly renovated, well-designed apartment, the idea of living in a Niemeyer original design is mostly what attracted him to the building.
I like Oscar Niemeyer because everything is so clean that you can put yourself in the place. But it seems to me that this construction is much, much better than the things that they're doing today.
You were always attracted to this building, even though when you see at the front, it's a bit raw and rough around the edges. It has broken windows. It seems a bit run down from the outside. But when you come into your apartment, it's amazing the way it's designed. So is this kind of, you know, like rough exterior, but like warm heart on the inside type of building?
It sounds like me. But I like that creepy thing about JK. Everything here has a sort of charm because everything's so open. I think the architectures help with ugly things, maybe.
As we wrap up our chat, Paulo invites me in for a coffee with a few of his neighbors, and the sense of home can be felt. Now, no matter how unconventional living in the JK building might seem when the idea was conceived over 60 years ago, or is still even viewed today, the building is still occupied by some of the most welcoming and hospitable people in Brazil, mineiros. And mineiro hospitality is alive and well among the residents in the JK building. And just like Oscar Niemeyer had intended, it's making it a space for everyone. For Monocle, in Belo Horizonte, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
And you can read the full report, plus see a range of sumptuous snaps in the February issue of Monocle magazine, which is available at any respectable newsstand you'd care to visit. Sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell, and the show's producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan. If you have any comments or queries, then do feel free to drop Henry a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the self-same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. And please do leave us a review on the latter, as long as it's positive. It really does help people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. And until next time, goodbye.